In Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we've learned from past shows that a lot of you like to collect things. We'll hear from a guest with a unique and seasonal collection, Halloween decorations for the early 1900s to the 1950s. He says Halloween used to be for the grown-ups more than the kids. First, this year, Wisconsin Public Radio is going beyond the ballot, asking people what issues are important to them this election season. The state of our roads is one of those issues that gets people talking. We've got two stories today that take a look at what people are saying about the state's deteriorating bridges and highways and where the candidates for governor stand on the issue. First, here's Bridget Bowden.
In every corner of Wisconsin, we've heard people say the same thing about the roads. They need work. In Kenosha, there's Rachel Anderson.
The roads in my area are horrible, horrible, horrible. I know it's been brought up, but something needs to change. It's causing taxpayers tons of money every year to deal with these crabby, crabby roads. I'm sick of it.
In Toma, there's Shannon Gebauer.
Roads, bridges, everything seems to be kind of deteriorating. We see a lot of patchwork going on.
Kathleen Redmond in Milwaukee.
I know there's a lot of funding going on, but I don't know why we don't have usable streets.
And Craig Coleman in Green Bay.
The roads around here are horrible, and they need to do something about that.
According to an audit of the State Department of Transportation, 32.8% of Wisconsin state highways were in fair, poor, or worse condition in 2015. It's something Robert Swenson from northwestern Wisconsin has seen firsthand.
Well, I was in Ladysmith the other day, and I think they should probably just close them roads and let people walk because you ruin your car driving on them. But there's not potholes, they're just a constant source of ridges and dips and bounces.
Not every voter has an opinion about why roads are in bad shape, but Swenson has a theory. In 2006, a bipartisan coalition repealed a long-standing law that indexed the gas tax or tied it to inflation. Swenson thinks that was a mistake.
And everybody thought it was wonderful because they were saving probably $5, $10 a year, and now our infrastructure is falling apart.
Mark Gottlieb, the former secretary of the State Department of Transportation, is a civil engineer by trade. He says roads deteriorate for a few reasons.
Water is kind of the enemy of a pavement. So you see that weather-related those cycles of freeze and thaw, deterioration. And then you also see deterioration from repeated traffic loading, and that's mostly trucks generally.
But harsh weather and heavy trucks aside, Gottlieb says it's primarily a funding issue in Wisconsin.
We just don't have enough money to maintain what is fundamentally a depreciating asset. I mean, a road and a bridge, they have a specific life span to them, and if you aren't making the investments you need to make at the right times during that lifespan to keep them up, then what you're going to find is a natural deterioration of their condition.
A lot of possible solutions have been tossed around by politicians. Everything from raising the gas tax to borrowing more money to implementing toll roads. It's a big question, and Robert Swenson doesn't see a clear solution.
Where are we going to get the money from? Raise the taxes? Well, you can't do that because people don't want to pay more money. They want the cream, but they don't want to raise the cow, so to speak.
All of this is playing out in the 2018 campaign between Republican Governor Scott Walker and Democratic challenger Tony Evers. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Bridget Bowden.
And I'm Sean Johnson. In Wisconsin's governor's race, there's not much overlap between Evers and Walker when it comes to transportation. It's been Evers who's talking about how bad the roads have gotten, pinning the blame on Walker.
Scott Walker has drawn a line in the sand around transportation, and as a result, our roads are crumbling. We have people in northern Wisconsin that are scraping the asphalt off the road and they're driving on gravel roads.
And it's been Walker who's been warning that if Evers becomes governor, he'll raise gas taxes.
Ladies and gentlemen, you need to be ready for a massive gas tax increase.
Todd Berry is a longtime budget analyst who ran the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance for 25 years. He says Evers and Walker are as different as any candidates he remembers when it comes to what they're saying about road funding.
I can't remember it being this you know, this black and white.
Evers has attacked Walker on the state of Wisconsin's roads more than either of his previous Democratic opponents. He's had help from Wisconsin's Operating Engineers, a road building union that endorsed Walker in his first run for governor. They're backing an ad campaign against Walker that encourages people to send in pictures of damaged roads. The group calls them Scott Holes.
Fix our roads, Governor. To learn more, go to scottholes.com. Paid for by Safe Transportation Over Politics.
Evers says everything's on the table when it comes to paying for roads, from tolls to an increase in the gas tax. He says if he's elected governor, both parties will work together toward a solution.
Republicans and Democrats get this idea. The only person in the way of solving this infrastructure problem in the state of Wisconsin is Governor Walker.
There's polling that suggests Evers has the public support here. The latest Marquette University Law School poll showed 64% of Wisconsin residents think their roads are in fair or poor condition. But when it comes to what to do about those roads, pollster Charles Franklin says it's a different story. He says Marquette has been asking these questions for years.
And in every one of those cases, we find a demand for better highways and at exactly the same time, a reluctance to pay for it.
In the latest Marquette poll, 61% said they don't want to pay higher taxes or fees for roads. Those are the voters Walker's going after. During the last budget cycle, he sparred with his fellow Republicans in the legislature who wanted to raise taxes or fees to pay for roads.
I will veto any changes made to the budget that add to the overall burden of the taxpayers of this state.
This year, he's been attacking Evers for his willingness to raise the gas tax. Walker even cut a 15-second ad that plays on video screens at gas pumps.
Hi, it's Scott Walker. Good thing you're filling up, because if Tony Evers wins, he'll raise the gas tax by as much as a dollar a gallon.
That's been amplified by TV ads from his campaign.
He's going to raise the gas tax by up to a dollar a gallon.
And conservative groups like Americans for Prosperity.
Evers is open to gas tax hikes, even a dollar more per gallon.
Evers has never said he'd support a $1 per gallon increase in the gas tax. Asked what he had to say about Walker's claim at the last debate, Evers responded,
"Holy mackerel is what I say. Of course, the people of Wisconsin understand, except for Scott Walker keep repeating it, a dollar a gallon is ridiculous. It's never going to happen."
Wisconsin's current state gas tax is 31 cents per gallon. It's remained the same for more than 12 years. The trade-off is that data shows Wisconsin roads are getting worse, and the public has noticed. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Sean Johnson.
That was a feature produced by WPR reporters Bridget Bowden and Sean Johnson. Right now, if you've browsed the Halloween section at your local department store lately, you probably saw some fake cobwebs, spider rings, plastic skeletons to hang in your door, and more. Turns out people have been interested in decorating for the Halloween holiday for more than a century, though the graphics, the messaging, and the materials have changed a lot over time. And there's a large group of collectors who search high and low to find these vintage Halloween decor items, like a party invite from the 1920s or an early 1900s ring toss party game. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Do you look forward to decorating for Halloween, indoors or out? If so, why do you get into the game? Do you think the way we celebrate Halloween has changed or is changing? Are you a collector yourself of vintage Halloween memorabilia? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mark Ledenbach has been collecting vintage Halloween items since the 1980s. He's appeared as an expert appraiser on American Pickers, and his collection has been featured in many magazines and television shows like Country Home and Antiques Roadshow. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob, thanks for having me. How are you?
Well, good. Now, before we get into your collection and what's out there to collect, Mark, you've written that Halloween has changed a lot in the last 100 years. It used to be mainly for grown-ups. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It was an adult-focused holiday through basically all the 1930s. And then once the 40s and the war era ended, it became more of a children or child-focused event.
So how would the grown-ups celebrate Halloween back in those days?
Well, I wish I could go to one of those parties. They would have a party, and they would buy all kinds of decorations that were sold in dime stores. And they'd have their adult friends come over, and they'd play games like Canasta or Bridge or Whist or Mahjong, any of those games that were popular back then. And And depending on how you as a guest did that night in terms of being lucky or not, you would get parting gifts. And those parting gifts were things like candy containers and nodders and figurals that today are worth a lot of money because they're very, very hard to find.
And Mark, how did you first get into collecting these older Halloween items and decorations?
It was a fluke. I was in an antique store in 88, and the proprietor of the store asked if I would help her move some boxes, and I said sure, and I asked to see what was in the boxes, and it was all this vintage Halloween that I had never really paid any attention to before or had seen. And that started it, and that's been 30 years ago now, 30 years ago this month.
And talk about some of the earlier stuff, the early 1900s Halloween decorations. What kind of stuff was out there then?
Well, it started basically with postcards. Right after the turn of the last century, you would buy all kinds of hundreds of different designs of postcards that you would send to your friends. And it morphed from just sending postcards to, let's celebrate this holiday, let's get together with our friends. And so American manufacturers, paper manufacturers like Denison or Beistel, both of which are in business still today, they would start cranking out decorations, not only for the home, but for businesses. And people got into it. And so if you went to one of those stores, you'd buy crepe paper, and you might make decorations just by hand using that crepe paper. And as 1913, 1914, 1915 comes around, those companies started to manufacture party goods, invitations, place cards, where you'd sit at a table, tally cards, who's winning the games, and all kinds of die cuts, which are basically paper, cardboard pressed, sometimes not pressed, that would be hung up on walls. And you'd go into a house that was decorated for the season, and I guess you would feel very festive. Looking back now at all the decorations that were used back in those early times, I can see how festive it would be. And Halloween material today is very hard to find from that era, meaning from about 1912 forward to about 1950, because no one really cared about it. They would, after the party was over, they would just throw everything away. Very different than Christmas, where the items that come out at Christmas time are generally treasured. Halloween wasn't treasured at all, and so today that lack of care translates into true scarcity.
I want to bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Owen is with us in Wyawega. Owen, hello.
Yes, hi. I had the great opportunity to actually see the die pets firsthand as a child. I was born in 78, but my mother's father was born in 1904. He had his first set of children in early 30s, and then he had my mother starting in the 50s. 51, my mother was born. So anyway, we inherited these hand-me-downs from generations to generations of these old die pets, is what the guest is speaking of. I remember them real vividly colored black cats and orange jack-o'-lanterns that you would put little party favors inside of these die pets and set them at people's places. And I always thought it was just amazing how vivid and beautiful the artwork was. And they were just made out of paper, cardboard kind of material. And I can imagine why they don't last, because if you don't take care of them, they wouldn't last. But these were always something my mother took down from the attic in the around Halloween, and she would set around on the table just like they did back in the 20s or 30s or whatever. And then she'd always hand make our Halloween costumes. We never had anything bought. We never went and bought stuff at Dollar General.
And Owen, I got to ask, are those classic Halloween decorations still around in the family?
Well, yeah, some are. I mean, I can remember as a child, I think we were a little abusive towards them because we didn't understand the value. And then, you know, as time went on, things got a little bit more fragile, and my mother probably put some stuff up that we never got to actually look at. But as long as we weren't allowed to touch and handle things, it would have lasted another 50 years easily.
Oh, and thanks a lot for the call. And, Mark, yeah, there's got to be a lot of attrition in families over the years, especially if the kids got to play with some of this stuff.
Absolutely. You know, children playing with things, tape, tack holes, all of those things are mortal dangers to vintage Halloween collectibles.
Oh, and thanks
for sure.
Thanks a lot for that call. We are talking about Halloween decorations, especially vintage classic ones. Mark Ledenbach is with us. He collects these. He's written a book, actually, about them. It's called Vintage Halloween Collectibles. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have some Halloween decoration memories? Are you a big fan of decorating for Halloween with old or new stuff in the modern day? Call 800-642-1234. Mark, I understand another classic era is the 1930s, 20s and 30s, I guess, where we started to import a lot of decorations from Germany?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The Germans were desperate to make some cash because of their World War I activities, and they were able to generate some cash by making really wonderful, very intricate holiday decorations, not just for Halloween. They did every holiday, Easter, Christmas. But Halloween, they made things called die cuts. They were heavily embossed, pressed out, and sold in stores. And some of these die cuts today are, it started in the early 20s, and it ended by 1935. And that's about 15-year period. They cranked out many, many designs, some of which are what you'd expect, witches, black cats, owls, a few bats here and there, and then a few that you wouldn't expect that are just very odd. And those odder ones that were made pretty late in the run, 1934, 1935, today they're quite coveted and quite valuable.
What's one of those more unusual designs?
Well, there's a flying bat devil child, and there's two of them, the father and the son, you know, the father being much larger than the son, the die cut. And those are very, very scarce, and they go for anywhere, depending on condition. And condition is always the big gate that you have to successfully go through to get the big dollars if you're somebody wanting to sell. Condition is paramount. But those things sell for anywhere from $2,000 to $4,000 each. Yeah, it's all a function of scarcity. Very few survive. Like the Owen, the caller, his mother was atypical that she would keep things and bring things out. That's atypical. Typically, people would just throw it away and they'd buy new stuff next year because it was pretty cheap back then.
So we got another caller now. Will is with us in Eau Claire. Will, hi.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Just a couple of quick enjoyable stories about my childhood as growing up in Southland, Indiana. A couple callers ago, a fellow mentioned that his mother or family would bake all the costumes. Same thing with me. And we just had great fun as kids going around in these homemade costumes from block to block. And I remember one in particular. My father, who is in the East Coast, thought it would be a great idea if I went as a lighthouse one year. So he made this thing, and I almost died inside of it. I couldn't breathe, and it was hot.
Oh, no.
And anyway, it was just, it's a great memory. And my wife just loves Halloween now. So we just get together with friends and have a great time. It's just a real jovial celebration. So.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for that. Sorry, yeah. I'm glad you made it through that lighthouse costume. And Mark, is there a collector's market for older classic costumes as well as these decorations?
Not really.
Really?
Costumes are sort of, yeah, they're not very, they're not collected. I'm sure there's a few people out there that do like them and collect them, but in terms of a strong secondary market, it does not exist for costumes, except if they were boxed costumes professionally sold. And today they have some relation to a popular or obscure even television show or movie. Other than that kind of entertainment connection, they trick-or-treat bags and costumes both are just not loved in the secondary market.
Will, thanks for sharing your story. Mark, since you stumbled into Halloween collecting about, 30 or so years ago, has the market for these items changed over the years?
Yeah, it's gotten to the point that the prices for vintage Halloween collectibles in great shape are astronomically high. And it's a little worrisome in terms of the health of the hobby because it's gotten so expensive. I don't see how people who are wanting to begin collecting Halloween can get much of a collection together given the prices today.
Now, is there a holy grail, or I guess for Halloween, unholy grail that you wish you had in your collection?
Well, there are some German die cuts that are very hard to find that have eluded my grasp for 30 years. So, yeah, there's a couple of German die cuts that I'd like to have. But, you know, I've been collecting a long time, and I've worked hard at building up my collection. And so there really aren't a whole lot of pieces out there that I really want anymore. There's a few. And I always hope that maybe, you know, as I check my email every morning, that there's a lead on some of these items. But by and large, I'm very, very pleased with what I've been able to collect over these 30 years. And I sure am glad that I started collecting when I did, because prices then were reasonable. And, you know, today prices are a little less reasonable. And it's hard to amass a sizable collection.
In our last just few moments, how do you celebrate Halloween yourself?
You know, basically, I like to stay home. I buy full-size candy bars for any of the trick-or-treaters, and I hand those out, and I decorate the exterior of my house with some lights and a few things. But I like the social aspect of Halloween.
All right, and I'll swing by for some of those full-size candy bars. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Mark Ledenbach. He's been collecting vintage Halloween items since the 1980s. He's the author of the book Vintage Halloween Collectibles. You can check out some of his collection at HalloweenCollector.com. First, more and more school districts in the United States are shifting to a four-day school week. About 600 districts in at least 22 states, not including Wisconsin, have made the move, according to the Wall Street Journal. That's up from about 120 districts in 17 states a decade ago. Districts say it's a way to lower costs and attract teachers, plus kids like the longer weekends, and some studies say it has educational benefits. Tonnell Hobbs is the K-12 national education reporter for the Wall Street Journal. She's been covering this issue. Tonnell, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, hello. How are you?
Good. Well, this is not an overwhelming wave of schools, but it's on the rise. What is the appeal? Why are schools saying, yeah, we're trying this four-day school week?
You know, it always starts out with saving money. These districts are looking to save money, but, you know, what they find is that it also attracts teachers. So there's these unexpected benefits that they're getting, so they're really loving it right now.
Now, most schools, most states have requirements for how many hours kids have to be in school. So what ends up working out? Do they have longer school years or longer school days to balance out the math?
Basically, they just extend the day and they have longer school days. And it just depends. I mean, for some of these districts, they're not having to add a lot of time. It could be, you know, if they're already meeting the minimum time instructional hours, they might only have to add 20 minutes, you know, but some are having to add up to, you know, 90 minutes a day.
Is this something that's happening in public and private schools?
You know, I have noticed some private schools, but the problem with they're just not tracked well like the public schools are, as far as the states actually know which public school districts are doing it, because they do have those minimum hour requirements.
There are a lot of objections people have to this idea. We can get into those in a bit. But when schools have been, and you talk to some district leaders around the country, when schools introduce this, is there a lot of pushback, especially from parents?
You know, and that's the parents, they are the ones that are more likely to push back, more so than the teachers. And the concern is, you know, what are we going to do with our child on that day off? So what I've noticed these districts doing, they will, you know, kind of rally the community, and they, you know, community, some of the nonprofits will have discounted daycare. The Boys and Girls Clubs are good for that. And then also I noticed these districts pulling through when it comes to food. They will either open up their campuses to make sure kids eat, because that's another concern. Some of these communities are pretty poor. And that might be the only meal that child gets during the day is at school. So there's been concern that kids would be unattended and hungry. So the school districts are opening up some of them anyway and feeding the kids, or they're providing the meals to some of these nonprofits to feed them.
On the money side, you mentioned this starts as a cost-saving measure. How does that work out? How does the school end up saving money by going to 4 days a week instead of five?
Well, you know, they save money on transportation. They're not running the buses. They're saving money on utilities. Some of them save money on food. There's a small savings for some of them on personnel costs. It just depends on your hourly workers.
Talking to Tonnell Hobbs from the Wall Street Journal, she's been covering the idea of a four-day school week. It's been growing in states around the country, not here in Wisconsin yet. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea? What questions do you have about how it works? Would you want to see it in your district? If you're a parent, a student, a teacher, I'd love to hear from you. 800-642-1234. What kind of things, Tonnell, did you hear from people in school districts about what changed after they made this change down to 4 days?
You know, for the teachers, they actually said the kids seemed well-rested. They seemed more focused. They noticed fewer absences with the children, I guess, since they get the three-day weekend. They're not, you know, calling in sick as much. And then also some of the principals I talked to noticed that teacher absences had went down too. Now, as far as the teachers go, they are having to make some adjustments to their schedules. For instance, if your district is off on Fridays, you know, some of these teachers aren't likely to test on Monday, and they're more likely to use that day as a refresher day and test on Tuesday because they're thinking, oh, they just had a three-day weekend. You know, we need to make sure they retain this. Let's refresh them on Monday and then test them on Tuesday. So there are some schedule adjustments.
And how about, you wrote a lot about job retention for teachers. People talk about teachers having to, you know, spend their weekends grading papers and things like that. What kind of things did you hear about the schools trying to retain teachers?
Well, and that's a big part of it. Now, these school districts, you know, like I said, the initial factor is saving money, but then they realize, wow, you know, teachers are kind of attracted to this three-day weekend, and if we can't boost salaries that much, maybe we can lure them with the promise of a three-day weekend. So I'm definitely seeing more districts using it as a recruiting tool just to get the teacher interest. And teachers really seem to like the three-day weekend.
Let's go to a caller now. Amanda is with us in Manitowoc. Amanda, hi. Amanda, hi. What do you think of this idea?
So I am a teacher myself, and I actually like the idea because being a teacher is a home-school balance. Right now, I speak maybe for many teachers, is just way out of whack. You know, we're not given the amount of time to work on our quote-unquote homework at school. And, you know, maybe we're less of little time to spend with our own families because we bring a lot of that homework home. So the four-day week might give us a day out of the week where we could do prep or, you know, grading, things like that.
Amanda, thanks for the call. So Amanda's saying she could see that, getting that, using that Friday or Monday, I guess, whichever day it is, to catch up on prep. Is that what you're hearing in districts that have
that
tried this?
I heard so much from teachers, and they said when they go to this four-day school week, they finally feel like they have a weekend because so often they spend, you know, one day out the weekend grading papers or catching up, and all of a sudden you look up and your weekend feels like it was one day long. When they have this three-day weekend, they said they actually feel like even if they do a little work during the weekend that they still have a weekend.
Amanda, thanks a lot for calling in at 800-642-1234. Tonnell, has there been research on how four-day weeks affect a student performance?
You know, that's a great question. And, you know, even in there's been studies and in talking to principal and teachers, they have not found that this compact week has had any kind of negative effect on student learning. Some principals report higher test scores because they say the kids just are more rested, and they come in fully alert, ready to go. But I haven't seen any, studies that show that academics suffer. I haven't heard from any principals or teachers that said that either. So, and that was always the big concern, will academics suffer? And that just doesn't seem to be the case.
Did you hear from schools saying, okay, we did this for cost, this is a contingency, when we can afford this, we're just going to go back to the 5-day a week as soon as we can?
You know, that's the thing about this. It is so hard to go back to the 5-day week after being on 4-day. And it's because that, these families and staffers, they just grow attached to having that 3-day weekend. I came across a few districts that did go back to 5-day once their financial picture looked better, because they had made the promise to the community that they would do that. But still, even, one of the principals told me not too long ago, she's like, I'm hearing from families, and they said, hey, we'd rather go back and have those 3-day weekends again. So it is kind of hard to move from a 4-day once you go to it.
Weird from Nancy on Facebook. Nancy wrote, that would be too long a day for most children. Also, how are working parents supposed to manage daycare? Surely we can manage to find money in our budgets for something as important as education. You touched on the daycare issue already. If the school day has to be longer, 20 or 90 minutes or whatever, is there a concern that, especially for the younger kids, that's too long to keep the Wiggles away?
Yes, there's always that concern, especially for the really young kids. And I've seen some of these districts, they might, give an extra break or, kind of rearrange the schedule where maybe they're doing some of the classes that kids might find more boring towards the beginning of the day, and then maybe saving like the art classes or the gym classes where, they're going to be more alert and it's going to wake them up during towards the end of the day. So there definitely are schedule adjustments. And, that has been a concern, too, about longer days. And that's kind of how districts have, they've kind of rearranged their schedules to do maybe the more fun activities or more things that might get kids more excited towards the end of the day to keep them up.
Let's bring on another caller now. Dan is on the line in Racine. Dan, hello.
Well, yeah, I just wanted to say that as a kid in Colorado, we had the 4-day school week. And actually, it was probably the best year, couple years, as far as grades went, because I just always felt more relaxed come the day of school. And the way they pushed it was that they also had them extra days in case there was school, like a snowstorm or stuff like that, then they could make days up easier. I just always felt like it was a better setup for a kid. You just had that extra day of rest. And when you went back, you didn't mind that extra hour. You were already at school.
Huh. And Dan, can I ask if I can get personal here, about how long ago were you in school?
Oh, it's been quite a while. I graduated in 89, so this was in the mid-80s.
Gotcha. Dan, thanks a lot for the call. And you mentioned Colorado, which is a lot of what you covered, Tonnell. They're kind of the innovators on 4-day weeks.
Oh, yes. They got more than half of their school districts use 4-day now.
All right. Dan, thanks a lot for the call and for sharing your experience. We're talking about the growing number of school districts around the country turning to a 4-day school week. Tonnell Hobbs is with us, Wall Street Journal K-12 education reporter. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea? If you're a parent, a teacher, administrator, what would you think about the idea of a 4-day school week in your school? If you're a student yourself, how does this sound? Maybe a little longer on those 4 days, but Friday off, or maybe Monday off. This isn't happening in Wisconsin. There was an effort in the Eau Claire area, not the Eau Claire district, but nearby to do this. Ended up being rejected by the school board. Do you want it where you are? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our discussion about 4-day school weeks, a concept that's catching on nationwide over the past few years, not, though, here in Wisconsin yet, as far as we can find. Tonnell Hobbs is our guest. She's the K-12 national education reporter at the Wall Street Journal. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about how this works? What do you think of the idea of a 4-day school week? Would you want it in your schools here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back to your calls now. Sue is with us in Fish Creek. Sue, hi.
Hi. How are you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I have a concern about the school lunch programs. Northern Door County was discounted from summer during the summer, and we privately, citizens, made it happen. So when I hear that the kids are going to get lunch programs at school and they need the bus to get to school, I don't see that as a cause that will work. The kids won't be able to get to the lunches even if they're serving the lunches. And then my other concern is with homework workload. Does this mean that teachers can load the kids up with more homework?
Gotcha, Sue. Thanks for the call. So that concern about, as you were talking about a little bit earlier, Tonnell, yeah, kids who rely on the school lunch program, are they going to end up back at school just for that?
That was a great question, Sue. Basically, what's going on, I mean, I didn't find a lot where school districts were actually running buses to get kids to the school to eat. It seemed to be strategic, like they kind of looked at different locations and said, okay, maybe, you know, kids could come over here to this nonprofit and we'll you know, take the meals over here and we'll take the meals over here. And they try to spread out the meals within the city. But, you know, like I said, the food thing, it was a big concern. And you got to realize, even when they run buses, that some of these districts probably could make more of a profit, but they are still serving meals. They might run a bus to go drop food off. So that does cut into some of the profit. But like I said, it seems like even when the profit is not there, when it's a small profit, they're the love of this four-day week. They just still love it. They think that it's a magnet to attract teachers. They think that it lessens the absenteeism rate for students and teachers, and they stick with it. And she had another part of her question, too.
It was about homework. She wondered if teachers might load up kids with more homework to do, maybe on that three-day weekend.
No, you know, I didn't see, and I asked specifically about that, and that didn't seem to be the case at all. Because I was very curious to see if they would load them up, and that doesn't seem to be the case.
Thanks for the call, Sue, and those questions. We'll go now to Grace with us in Menasha. Grace, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Grace?
I just wanted to bring up the fact that most parents are working on Friday, so what would they do if their kids are off on Friday? They would have to put them in some daycare of sorts.
Grace, thanks for the call. We touched on that, Tonnell, but there's that concern of those either unsupervised kids or parents having to scramble.
There is. And you know, the thing about it is the school districts that I researched, they did seem to go out their way to make sure that there was either a cheap or free daycare. There's actually one district in Virginia, and they're looking at doing it, but they actually can't do it right now because they don't have daycare set up and things like that, and they know it would put parents out. You know, that still is probably the biggest concern with parents is what are we going to do? Because even, you know, if your money is tight, even just paying, you know, a small fee for that Friday off, and some districts actually take Monday off too on a smaller scale, but they do, or Monday off, it's still a problem. What I have found, I did go circle back to parents who initially had concerns about paying, and even sometimes they come around because they just really like having that extended weekend. Some of them use it to take, you know, little small family trips or family time, and for the most part, a lot of parents really like it, even ones that start out nervous about, you know, that day off if they have to work.
Grace, thanks for that call. We're talking to Tonnell Hobbs from the Wall Street Journal, looking at four-day school weeks. More districts around the country giving them a try, not yet here in Wisconsin. Corey joins us next in Watertown. Corey, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going? I think it'd be doable because when I was in high school back in the late 70s, our school district was overcrowded. So our high school had to have what they called a split shift. They had juniors and seniors went to school from 7 a.m. till noon, and then the freshmen and sophomores went from noon to 5. and everybody seemed to make that work.
Corey, thanks a lot for the calls. Corey's saying, hey, we can be flexible, and if we do it right, it seems to work out. He was looking at a split shift there, a little different, but schools seem to be making do.
Yeah, they do. And actually, when he brought that up, when I was in elementary school, that kind of happened to us. We had an asbestos issue at our school, and we had to go to another school, and they kind of split us up like that, and they did make it work.
Thanks for the call and sharing your experience. Nancy joins us now in Menominee. Nancy, hi.
Hi, yes. I'm just wondering how schools correlate with each other. My children are heavily involved in sports, and one school is system, what day is not sports related, or even the length of the school day. Sometimes the kids have to get out of school that hour early to travel. In this neck of the woods, our kids are traveling an hour to sporting events. So how does that happen?
Nancy, thanks. Yeah, Tonnell, did schools talk to you about how they handled sports events if they were on different calendars and schedules than everybody else?
Yeah, and that's another juggling act right there, the sports events. I talked to a couple parents that, you know, when school goes later, then kids are practicing later. They didn't like that. No, what they did like was that on that day off, I did notice, especially when I was in Pueblo, Colorado, I noticed a lot of the sports teams practicing on that Friday off. So they liked it from that standpoint. But, you know, it's obviously not perfect. But for the most part, a lot of these districts are making it work. Even concerns they initially had, they're working them out.
Thanks for the call, Nancy. So, Tonnell, we're seeing the number of districts, I think, multiply by five around the country over a decade or so. Are we getting to a critical mass where now other districts are saying, well, somebody else has tried it, worked the bugs out of the system, maybe we should consider it too?
You know, that's a great question, because what I found is this started out in, you know, the western U.S., and now it's starting to move eastward. And there's states that I just, you know, never thought would even go to 4-day, or they're looking at it. So it is saturated in the western U.S., but it is moving eastern too. And what these states are doing, they're looking and saying, wow, they're saving some money, and it's a recruiting tool, and they're attracting teachers. So, you know, and it depends on your state. Some states you have to actually get approval by the state to do this, but some states it's just going through the school board and doing it. But it is definitely getting interest more and more. Like I said, we actually did a map in the newspaper and online, and you could actually see, you know, the saturated areas in the west, but as you went east, some of those states are starting to fill in because they're starting to do it.
We'll leave it there for now. Tonnell, thanks a lot for joining us today and sharing your reporting on this.
Oh, thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Tonnell Hobbs. She's a Wall Street Journal K-12 national education reporter. We talked with her about a growing number of schools around the country that are implementing a 4-day school week, going from 5 to 4, usually with a little extra time tacked on to each of those 4 days. And according to a lot of the schools she's talked to, seeing good results for students, teachers, administrators, and after some initial misgivings, parents getting on board too. We've heard from a bunch of you over at the Ideas Network Facebook page, and there's still time for you to share your thoughts on the idea of a 4-day school week. Is this something, if you work at a district, is this something you've considered, talked about at the preliminary level? Is this something you would want for your kids, for yourself? Actually, if you're a student, we'd love to hear from you. Would you like to see a 4-day school week at your school? Again, let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page. That's Leonardo DiCaprio feeling pretty good early on in the movie Titanic, before he's on the actual Titanic itself. Well, now you can have a chance to feel like the king of the world with a trip on the Titanic, too. This plan's been in the works for a while, the construction of a modern-day Titanic replica. The builders have announced a maiden voyage now. It's set for 2022. First, the ship goes from Dubai to London. Then it recreates the original Titanic's journey across the Atlantic. You know, up to a point. Here's what the ship will recreate. It's supposed to have the same cabin layout as the original, and it'll carry the same number of crew and passengers, roughly. That's about 2,400 passengers and 900 crew members. There'll be some, you know, little modern updates, though, like GPS and a bunch of modern safety and navigation technology. All good moves. I wonder about the market, though. Like, are there a lot of people out there who want to go on the new version of the Titanic? I'm not superstitious, but I sometimes believe in just not tempting fate. So best of luck when 2022 rolls around for that maiden voyage for the Titanic 2. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.